welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Because of our special holiday schedule, I'm talking to you from Washington here on the afternoon, late afternoon, of Tuesday, December 23rd. That is, it's Christmas Eve Eve, and we have some good news. Another step towards a Greek general election, a chance for the Greeks to vote no to the hated austerity. Down with austerity. Stop austerity. That's going to be the call coming out of the cradle of Western civilization there in Athens and in Greece. More widely, it has proven impossible for the reactionary coalition, the puppets of the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commish, impossible for them to impose their puppet candidate as president of Greece. So the new democracy and the, all these puppets of the Troika, right, European Central Bank, European Commission, and International Monetary Fund, they are at their wits' end. They don't know what to do. And it's looking more and more likely that it will be impossible now. The third vote, I believe the number of parliamentary supporters goes down from 180 to 160 to elect a puppet in this case. But it's not likely that they'll get the 160. And that will mean early elections. Vote. Let the people decide. And they will decide stop austerity, roll back austerity, make the bankers pay, and that, we'll talk about this in just a minute about what the potentials are, but that's a Christmas present for anybody. And of course, by the time you hear this, it's not even Boxing Day, it's, the Feast of Stephen or the Holy Innocents or whatever it is, but you'll be getting the idea. Secondly, the, course, the promised, philosophical seminar, economic seminar, the political economy of the American system, looks more and more likely for the 23rd, 24th, 25th. And I'm embarrassed to say we still don't have the venue. So I'm hoping to get that venue locked in, lined up, signed, sealed, and delivered very soon. You just have to bear with us a little bit. We were very concerned about Reverend Pinckney. So if we have an excuse, it's that. I don't want to seem to be dithering with these things, but we were heavily engaged on the Pinckney front and actually remain so. So that's going to be coming up. Watch Webster G. Tarpley Twitter feed. Watch Tarpley.net. And, of course, tune in to this broadcast next time around. I'll be very embarrassed if I don't have a venue for you. Now, the interesting, highly interesting developments here as the old year comes to an end. Let's look at some of these. First of all, the economic crisis in Eastern Europe. And that, of course, includes Russia, which is now under heavy attack from the International Monetary Fund and its stooges, London and New York, calling the shots on that one. These are not markets. These are economic attacks. This is economic warfare, not the workings of some mythical neoliberal market. But now, in the middle of all of this, we've got a shining ray of light. We have Belarus. Gold is where you find it. Gold is where you find it. And this is now Belarus under President Lukashenko. And Lukashenko, for various reasons, is particularly hated by the Anglo-American elites. They would like to give him the Gaddafi treatment, or at least a color revolution, if they could. But Lukashenko is forewarned. He knows what a color revolution looks like. It's been tried a couple of times there. These are people who have seen the chaos of a color revolution in Ukraine right next door. They've seen what it has meant for places like Libya and Syria. I hope there are not too many dupes and useful idiots running around in Belarus, because this government has now established something which is of universal value, and that is economic self-defense. The government of Belarus, under President Lukashenko, in the capital of Minsk, has declared, first of all, if you want to export capital from Belarus, great, you pay 30%. You pay a tax of 30%. Almost one-third of your flight capital will go to help the treasury. So if you're a libertarian, if you're a rip-off artist, if you're a leech, a parasite, a tick on the body of Belarus, and you try to get out of town with your ill-gotten gains, great, you're going to take a haircut of 30%. This is how to treat speculators. This is how to treat those who go for economic warfare and call that their liberty. That's no liberty. That's license. That's sociopathic behavior. Belarus has shown the way. Remember in the previous crisis back in 1998, which is now on everybody's lips, it was Mahathir Mohamad of Malaysia who blazed the trail, showing under those conditions back then that a country that put in capital controls and exchange controls would have an easier time of riding out that crisis than at the present time. So Belarus says 30% tax on capital exports. It also means that it's all reportable. I imagine it means that you have to report it, and if they don't want you to do it, they're going to tell you, no, you can't do it at any price. Forget about the 30%. But it's this is capital controls, exchange controls, and then some. It's an exchange control with real teeth. This is exemplary. Go Belarus. And then the other thing they've done is if you're bringing an exchange into the country, if you bring in dollars, euros, or yen, or whatever it is, you can't just hoard that. You can't just sit on that. You've got to exchange one half of that for a Belarus ruble. So you got to change it into Belarus rubles, and that simply means that your export earnings will be a support operation to buy Belarus rubles to prop up the currency, to support the national currency, and to counteract the baleful effects of flight capital. Now remember, things have gotten much worse since 1998. In 1998, we had not had the general deregulation of the derivatives, in particular credit default swaps. That happened in the year 2000 with the Commodity Exchange Modernization Act signed by Clinton, whose wife now thinks she deserves to be president, based on what? Based on knocking down Glass-Steagall in 99 and liberalizing derivative plague for the world in 2000. Well, as a result of those actions, since 2000, we've had this tremendous growth, this cancerous growth, hypertrophy of derivatives, and the derivatives are being used to attack Russia. But Belarus has put up an effective barrier. This is a small country. It would be wonderful. The NATO people would love to have a color revolution in Belarus, knock off Lukashenko, and bring the NATO potential borders all the way into historic Russia, right? Practically to Smolensk. They'd get Minsk, and they would like to get very close to Smolensk, and let's hope they don't, because we don't want this. This is the road to World War III. Therefore, what Belarus has done is actually a step for peace. Now, on the internal front, if you go back and read Putin's press conference in Russia, in the Kremlin, last week, you'll see that he was asked about a coup d'etat. He was asked, are you ready to fight off a coup d'etat? The answer coming in the next segment here on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley reporting from Washington, D.C. Now, I'm going to repeat this later on in the show, but let's give you ways to express support for Reverend Edward Pinckney. He has been in jail now for 8 days since the 15th of December. He was handcuffed in the courtroom, dragged out, not on bail. That's already outrageous. You should be free on bail to organize your appeal. No, take him to the county jail, not even take a further away hellhole of the Michigan criminal justice system, of course, under the despicable Governor Snyder, who serves Wall Street. And Congressman Upton is there, too, and Whirlpool in this company town. So Pinckney needs your support. Send him a Christmas card. Send him greetings. Send him a Christmas card with a message of political support. Here we go. Write it down. I'll give this later in the program, but try to get it now. This is the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility. In parenthesis, then we need J.C.F. Jim Charlie Frank. J.C.F. in parens. So G. period. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility. Paren J.C.F. Warden. Randall Haas, the warden of the prison. Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L, H-A-A-S. Randall Haas, H-A-A-S. 3500, 3500, North Elm Road, Elm Tree, but Elm Road, Jackson, Michigan, J-A-C-K-S-O-N, M-I. 49201. Jackson, Michigan, 49201. So you've also got to put, I'm sorry, at the top, you've got to put strike this. This is the wrong address. I'm so sorry. It's further down on this thing. You've got to write to Edward Pinckney, Edward Pinckney, P-I-N-K-N-E-Y. Edward Pinckney, his inmate ID number is number 294671, 294671, at the Robert G., sorry, the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility. G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility, 3855 Cooper Street, 3855 Cooper Street, C-O-O-P-E-R Street, Jackson, Michigan, 49201. Jackson, Michigan, 49201. Send it to the second one. I'm sorry about the first one. This was not so clear on the notes that I've got here in front of me, but it's Reverend Pinckney. Number, there's a paren with a hashtag, a sharp, 294671, closed paren, G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility, 3855 Cooper Street, Jackson, Michigan, 49201. I'll repeat that later on. Send Reverend Pinckney greetings, but of course, he's a political guy. Send him something political, mixed in with the season's greetings, according to your preference. Okay. So, Belarus now says, if you want to have flight capital, you pay 30%. And it means everything is reportable. So that immediately gives a tremendous advantage to the Belarus government in Minsk. And if you earn any foreign exchange, you got to change half of that into Belarus rubles right away to support the currency. Now, we've got other people here. Kasyanov. Kasyanov is a former prime minister under Putin who has become a renegade, right? And, of course, the renegade party in Moscow is numerous because what are they? They're venal. They want money. So Soros goes in there and he says, how many former government ministers, you know, what does a government minister cost today? And they say, $5 million. And he says, I'll take 10 of them. So here's the outcome of that process with Kasyanov. Kasyanov essentially says, Putin, you should quit during 2015. Kasyanov, the former prime minister, wants Putin to resign in 2015 because allegedly his economic policies haven't worked. Well, the thing that's not working, of course, is that there's a Wall Street City of London economic assault. This is just as bad as 1941. This is an attack. This is economic warfare, and you got to defend yourself. And Belarus has shown us at least the beginnings, the ABCs of how to defend yourself. And then let's hear from another one. Not just Kasyanov, and you look him up, K-A-S-Y-N-O-V, but Kudrin. And Kudrin, I guess at this point, is the leader of this faction. You know the faction. Former Finance Minister Kudrin. Banker German Greff, G-R-E-F. Then you've got Silovanov, the Finance Minister now. You've got Nabiulina, Madame Nabiulina, the head of the central bank. And this Nabiulina especially is a satellite of the Federal Reserve and the IMF. But here's Kudrin, December 22nd. So Kudrin blames everything on Putin. Imagine that. Kudrin has to admit that there are numerous factors, but here's Kudrin. Today I can say we have entered or are entering a real full-fledged economic crisis. Next year we will feel it clearly. The government has not been quick enough to address the situation. I am yet to hear, it's clear, I have yet to hear, it's clear assessment of the current situation. So this is essentially you can say it's defeatist propaganda, right? It's an attempt to undermine the morale of the Russian people by saying you're to blame for this. Economics Minister Ulukayev is slightly better. He has some idea of a productive economy, but he's also out there calling this a perfect storm. What kind of stuff is this? This is the party of the foreigner, right? Le Parti de l'étranger, with Kudrin. And of course, his buddy Chubais is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and also on the board, one of the advisory boards of JP Morgan. So this is the group. And that's what happened when Putin was asked about a coup. And we will give you the answer next time. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tufte here in Washington, D.C. So here's the situation. We've got former Prime Minister Kasyanov saying that Putin should resign in 2015. We've got former Finance Minister Kudrin. Kudrin was fired, not even by Putin, but by Medvedev. Kudrin was somebody who said, Our respect of the neoliberal criteria is more important than our defense budget, even though the country is under attack. Remember, the watchword of this crowd is the laws of economic development are objective and universal. But what they call the laws of economic development is the lunacy of the Austrian school, the neoliberal consensus, the ripoff artists, the speculators, the predators, the parasites. That's Kudrin and Kasyanov. Now, it's a challenge to the entire Putin government. The Putin government is based on the idea that Putin does politics and strategy, military, political affairs, but the oligarchs run economics. And up to now, the oligarchs who have gotten slammed, like Khodorkovsky in 2003, back in November then, they were the ones who tried to say, we're going to butt in on your political sphere and have a coup and knock you off, right? If Berlusconi can be the richest man in Italy and therefore prime minister, then Khodorkovsky thought, Khodorkovsky should be the ruler of Russia because I'm the richest. No, said Putin. No, explained Putin. And Khodorkovsky went to jail for a decade in Siberia. But what we're getting now, inevitably, it's impossible to have a distinction between economics and politics, because what you're talking about is political economy, as in the coming course here, starting on the 23rd of January, the political economy of the American Revolution. But you get the idea. The idea that these are separate is an idea of the Austrian school and the various crackpot British and other subjectivist, obscurantist economic schools. So there's no such distinction. And we're probably being pushed towards a situation where Putin will have to revise that the essential compromise underlying his government for the past dozen years or so, which is that the since the New Year's Eve of 1999, I guess, that the oligarchs run the economy. Well, the oligarchs can't run the economy. And if you insist on giving the oligarchs the economy, then the entire thing comes down. So that's got to be avoided. And what these people want is they want to find a way to overthrow, to use the economic difficulties now generated obviously by Prince Bandar. Bandar is the guy. Bandar is the thinking head of this 2,000 to 3,000 tribe of degenerates calling itself the Saudi royal family. Bandar is the guy who says, pump. He says, pump, baby, pump, and flood the world with oil and smash Putin and smash Iran and smash Venezuela, certainly, in the process. Russia, I think, is not going to capitulate to that. And I think Iran either. Venezuela is more difficult to defend, but I think they're going to make some efforts, although one of their efforts may well be to default. Now, let's look at that. Suppose Venezuela defaults, right? We were citing last week that we've got estimates, 90% probability of default, 95% maybe now. Well, what about it? So that would bring down somebody in New York or London, I think. Last time around, as we mentioned, it was called long-term capital management of Connecticut, derivatives mongers. They blew, and Greenspan rushed in, and possibly thanks to the fact that we had former Federal Reserve officials on the board of long-term capital management, they got a quick backdoor bailout, several billion, because that would have blown a considerable hole in the worldwide speculative edifice. But remember, 1998 is the dawn of the derivatives era, and we are now in the sultry, decadent afternoon of the derivatives, right? It's almost sunset for the derivatives. So something's got to happen with that. In Putin's press conference, he was asked by a journalist, are you ready for a coup? What would you do if there's going to be a coup? Now, Putin has said in the past that he knows what a color revolution is and that he's going to fight a color revolution. This character Navalny, right, this thug, is supposed to be the great hero of democracy. Well, he's in the same class with Bel Hodge or somebody like this. These are no heroes of democracy, right? You've got Limonov, the national Bolshevik, meaning in effect neo-Nazi, and Garry Kasparov, right? This is a completely unprincipled congeries of adventurers and, narcissists, egomaniacs, what have you. So Putin is ready for that. And then he was asked, well, is there going to be a coup? And he said, well, I live in the Kremlin and it's well defended. Yeah, of course. The Kremlin is a fortress by definition. So if you're in the Kremlin and you can hold the Kremlin, then that's a whole lot. But you get the idea that in Moscow now, golpe, putsch is being discussed. That is a very, very dangerous thing, right? Suppose we have an attempted coup against Putin, similar to the one we had in the spring of 2003. Remember back then when the Mad Dog Bush, the younger regime, and Cheney, they were getting ready to attack Iraq, but they wanted to guarantee their own oil supply by putting in a suitable puppet in Venezuela, and they tried a coup, and Chavez fought back from the coup, and he defeated them, and after that, he was not so pliable for the entire rest of his time in office. He knew who his enemies were. Imagine they try to overthrow Putin and it doesn't work. And Putin is left there having had an object lesson. I would say at that point, quite a few oligarchs will have to be taking the, what can we say, the Orient Express, or the, they'll have to, abscond, right? They'll have to adroitly decamp, because otherwise it will not be a good time to be an oligarch in Russia. All right. So, who's the next long-term capital management? And please, don't try a color revolution in Russia. It's doomed. Not even in Belarus could you do it, and in Russia even less. So who do these people really think they are? Now let's switch over to the Ukraine for just a second. Poroshenko. Here's Poroshenko's Christmas gift to the world. The Ukrainian Rada, that infamous puppet parliament, right? There are two things you got to read. Lenin, what is the Ukrainian Rada? Stalin, what is the Ukrainian Rada? And it's not all that different. It's a tentacle of Western imperialism. So Ukraine has repudiated its own previous non-aligned position. And we have this clique of fascists, quite frankly, right? The adventurers there in the government, they want to join NATO. Are you crazy? What advantage is there for the American people to have an alliance with this bunch of bankrupt, warmonger, fascist adventurers? Remember, alliances are supposed to be for reciprocal advantage, right? You want to have an alliance, it means both countries get something out of it they otherwise wouldn't get. What could the U.S. get out of this except a pack of trouble? And of course, the fact that they have no stable government, and the fact that they have this territorial dispute means that they cannot be members of NATO. Not now, not ever. Nix. No NATO membership for the Ukrainian fascist clique. Back in a minute. Welcome back to A World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So the Ukrainian fascist clique wants to become part of NATO. The American people, of course, say no. Now, let me also point out, though, we have some interesting developments here. There could be some glimmer of realism coming from the think tanks here. And I'm looking at an essay here by Michael E. O'Hanlon. We know him. He was anti-Iraq war. Then he flipped and became pro-Iraq war. Not exactly a profile in courage. This you can find on the Brookings Institution website. And it's called December 7th, 2014, Crafting a Win-Win-Win for Russia, Ukraine, and the West. And I'll cut through all of the cover stories here. It's originally in the Washington Post. So he's got a bunch of conditions, but he's trying to have some element of realism. And the element of realism comes in that if you want to solve this Ukraine question, you've got to realize that Russia needs to have a sphere of influence. A sphere of influence, which simply means an area where hostile or potentially hostile foreign powers cannot set up puppet regimes. Just that simple. And that's essentially what he talks about. Now, you'll remember that when we had the crisis back in the earlier part of this year, we had Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger came forward and said that there should not be a membership in NATO by Ukraine, given it's formally impossible, and there are lots of NATO countries that will block it, so thank God, we hope. And also that the proper solution for Ukraine, and I had this out even before Kissinger, was Finlandization. In other words, Finland is an example of a country right on the border with Russia, Soviet Union then, which became a puppet state of hostile forces. It became a puppet of Hitler. The Mannerheim government in Finland was a puppet of Hitler. And it was used to attack Russia, right? The siege of St. Petersburg, of Leningrad. So you can't have this. So the basic, the beginning of realism is that Ukraine will not become a member of NATO. So here's what O'Hanlon says about that. NATO would be unapologetically retained with its current membership, but because of the new security arrangement, it could eschew further enlargement and increasingly play only a supporting role in European security, refocusing on missions outside Europe. Well, forget about that. That's, you know, imperialist, colonialist attacks on developing countries, right? Remember the NATO slogan in the 1980s was out of area or out of business. In other words, since the tensions in Europe were declining at that time in the 80s, that NATO would have to become an imperialist enforcer against countries like Argentina, let's say, outside of the defined area of the North Atlantic Treaty. And they did that. And that's been very, very bad. So we want to forget about that. We want to go back to the original NATO area of 1949 and forget about the imperialist, part. So, Ukraine and the United States would agree that Ukraine would not be a candidate for NATO membership now or in the future. And, the European Union would agree to work with Russia to make any possible future Ukrainian relationship with that union, including membership, compatible with Ukraine's participation in Russia's Eurasian Economic Union project. Now, that's not easy to do, but at least it has this idea that there are paramount Russian interests. And given the state of the world, that has to come first. Oh, you don't like that. Ever hear of the Monroe Doctrine? What do you think the Monroe Doctrine was? The Monroe Doctrine says the United States will not tolerate hostile puppet states, colonies, of hostile foreign extra-American powers anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And that was actually not that bad in the sense that it at least prohibited many imperialist adventures. Say Napoleon III in Mexico was slowed down by that. So, and you'll be interested to know that John Forbes Kerry of Skull and Bones has thrown the Monroe Doctrine out the window just in the last couple of years, that it's no longer in force. I guess he's doing that so that he can argue that the Russians can't have it either. But, of course, the U.S. had it for, what, 175 years? Monroe Doctrine, right? Controversial. But it's going to be controversial in this case, too. So the basic idea is, for the sake of world peace, we cannot have tiny cliques of fascists, adventurers, other turbulent forces dictating the state of the world. We simply can't have it. Ukraine will have to knuckle under to the general needs of Europe, United States, Russia, Canada, all of the participants, China, Japan. All of these are much more important than a group of tin pot fascistoid agitators in Kiev who happen to have control of the Rada at the moment because of a color revolution. So, again, it's take a look at this. It's the win-win. And, of course, this has caused a freak out. Crafting a win-win-win for Russia, Ukraine, and the West by Michael E. O'Hanlon and Jeremy Shapiro, Washington Post. But you can read it for free at the Brookings Institution website. So fine. And, of course, there are many, many freakouts in the Washington Post and elsewhere. All right. Now, Syria. We have some very interesting stuff. And again, it's some notion of realism is somehow creeping in. There may be something happening. These are things that deserve to be at least given critical support and expanded, right? They're much too timid. But here's the idea. We have a certain Syria expert called Nir Rosen, N-I-R-R-O-S-E-N. And a couple of months ago, he submitted a still-secret 55-page report to the State Department and to the National Security Council. I'm afraid he's given it to Robert Malley, I'm afraid very much that Robert Malley is now a senior director at the National Security Council. Robert Malley has no business being there. He is, to the best of my knowledge, a humanitarian bomber on the lines of Samantha Power. If he's not, show us. Deny it in words, and above all, refute that in deeds, Robert Malley, if that's not who you are. But here's the idea. The Neil Rosen report, 55 pages, and then there's an abstract of about a fifth of that. It says essentially the whole idea, this whole edifice of policy, which is based on the need to oust Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian government, is wrong. It's a failure. It's a loser. It helps terrorists. Don't do it. He says, in effect, what you need to do is to try to promote local ceasefires between the Assad government forces on the one hand and the various rebels on the other. This is in Foreign Policy, foreignpolicy.com. Look it up, Neil Rosen. So Neil Rosen writes to Robert Malley, there are no moderate insurgents. There are none that are moderate ideologically, nor are there any moderate by their actions. The Assad government, he writes, is strong in health, education, social welfare. It is progressive and secular, with a good civil service and actually an attempt to build infrastructure. What is the point of trying to overthrow this government? Back in a minute on World Crisis Media. Welcome to our second hour here in our Between the Years program. We're recording on the afternoon of Tuesday, the 23rd of December. You'll hear this weekend between Christmas and New Year's. So season's greetings to everybody of whatever persuasion, right? Especially to those of goodwill. And remember now, Reverend Pinckney is in jail, thanks to the machinations of this despicable machine. So it's Edward Pinckney, P-I-N-K-N-E-Y, number, hashtag, in other words, 294671, 294671, G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility, 3855 Cooper Street, C-O-O-P-E-R, Jackson, Michigan, 49201. That's 49201. So send some support to Reverend Pinckney, a card, a greeting, political encouragement to hang tough, because he's going to hang tough, but it's easier if people are clearly standing behind him. All right. So we're still going through this report by Neil Rosen, the 55-page single-spaced report that essentially repudiates the entire crackpot lunatic policy of Samantha Power, of Susan Rice, of John Forbes Kerry, of that crazy woman Patterson, right? Her love of the Muslim Brotherhood. She tried to overthrow General Sisi in Egypt, right? This embrace of Hamas, because Hamas is approved by Turkey and by Qatar. This is no good. So Neil Rosen, a realist, he says again, the Assad government is not the worst in that region by any stretch of the imagination. They have good health and education and social welfare. I would add, they have price subsidies. They have price subsidies on bread, on rent, on cooking oil, on heating. They have a panoply of stuff that we could dream about here. And again, it mainly helps the very poor. And you'll find the middle class, blasé, pro-Western individualist who wants a Mercedes-Benz and says, it doesn't help me, I want a Mercedes-Benz. Don't tell me about helping the poor to buy bread. Well, I'm sorry, that's exactly the ballgame right there. So, according to Neil Rosen, the Assad government is progressive and secular, staunchly secular, with a decent, actually a good civil service and an awareness of the need for infrastructure. So now, Neil Rosen continues, the rebels are fanatics. They have become hopelessly radicalized. They have been turned into terrorists. That's what they were from the beginning, but that's okay. We'll take it. Assad is staunchly secular. In other words, he says it's not that the Assad people are Alawites and they're fighting as Alawites against another group which is sectarian Sunni. No, it's that you have Sunni sectarians, I would say crazies, selected by Bandar and company, against a government which is in some respects Alawite in origin, but mainly it's staunchly secular. This is secularism against religious fanaticism. That's what it is. And Rosen gets that too. Robert Malley, of course, is going to get this. That is not encouraging. I can't imagine Robert Malley doing anything very good. But anyway, one of the things we want is we demand the publication of that report. So Nir Rosen, N-I-R-R-O-S-E-N, wouldn't comment for a story about this in Foreign Policy Magazine, that website. We want to see that report, because that report is a key to overthrowing the warmongers. And, of course, as soon as I say warmongers, remember, I should have mentioned this before, our slogan for the holiday season is hashtag Fire Allen for Xmas. Hashtag F-I-R-E-A-L-L-E-N. The Arabic number 4. X-M-A-S. Hashtag Fire Allen for Xmas. Fire Allen for Christmas. That's got to go out. I urge people, don't get diverted into struggles about torture from 10 years ago, right? Dick Cheney is an odious ogre. Fine. There are left liberals that will attack him, but there are no left liberals that are going to try to stop the next war, the coming war, the war that's hanging over our head. For that, you need hashtag Fire Allen for Xmas. And that goes right to this clique that's pushing Obama. They are worse than Obama, and they push Obama in directions that are worse than the ones that he might spontaneously choose. We're not for Obama, but have a brain. When there are people who are much bigger warmongers compared to Obama, attack the bigger warmongers. That's a good rule of thumb. If you're not attacking the biggest warmonger you can see, then indeed you are spinning your wheels when it comes to this kind of stuff. Now, let's see. The and ISIS. ISIS is in trouble. ISIS could be finished off. That's why Allen is working so hard. Allen is working and scheming day and night how to save ISIS. That's what he's doing. He says, we want to use ISIS against Syria. We want to use ISIS against Iran. We want to use ISIS in Chechnya against Russia. Well, no. Stop Allen. Fire Allen for Xmas. But the other thing here is ISIS itself, right? They have been, in spite of the fact that these airstrikes have not been as big as we wanted more. We wanted 1,000 bomber raid on one day. 1,000 sorties one day. Remember, Iraq, 1 month, 100,000 sorties 24 years ago. This time, 10, 20 sorties. We need more. Clobber ISIS. Clobber ISIS. Those are killers, right? No matter where they go, they're going to be killers. And here's the thing. A lot of their dupes and recruits, their useful idiots, have now seen the light and they're trying to leave. And what does ISIS do? They kill them. In effect, they shoot them in the back when they're trying to run away from this futile and idiotic conflict. The reports are now that ISIS has executed 100 would-be defectors. And largely, these are people who came from Europe and they were caught up in the hype, right? That ISIS was sophisticated, that it was a potent force, that it was formidable, that it was going to conquer the world for the caliphate, and you wanted to be part of it, and it was going to be a cakewalk. That was part of it too, the ISIS cakewalk. And now, of course, winter is there, There are bombings. Not enough, but there are bombings. The Kurds are hanging tough. The Syrian army is implacably marching towards Aleppo, actually trying to clear out neighborhoods of Aleppo. There's increased resistance coming from the Iraqi Kurds, increased resistance from the Iraqi army. The Shiite militias of the lower Euphrates have gone north of Baghdad and are effectively fighting and killing these ISIS characters. Remember, this is the CIA secret army in the Middle East. Started in Syria and Iraq in the mid-aughties. It was moved into Libya. It was then moved into Syria. And now it's what you see. It's 30 to 40,000 hardcore crazies. And if they are hurled into eternity, then the CIA's ability to act in the Middle East is strongly undermined. So they've killed 100 of them, mainly Europeans, who are disillusioned. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Remember, stay tuned. Sorry about the delays. Stay tuned here. It's going to be the 23rd, 24th, 25th of January in Washington, D.C. We sincerely hope. Don't quite buy the airline tickets yet. I don't want anybody to be hurt by the process. It's the process is a little bit out of our control. We have modest means. You want to give a contribution to the Tax Wall Street Party, that would certainly speed things along. And I'll probably have some kind of a method on my website that you can contribute to this thing. But watch above all the Twitter feed, because that's where you're going to find out right away. Okay, so 100 primarily European ISIS dupes executed, killed, shot in the back by these crazies, by the caliph, by Caliph Ibrahim of the new caliphate. And they believed all that garbage, and now they're dead. But we say, fire Allen for Xmas. That's the way anybody can contribute to peace in the Middle East now in the time. You know, we're headed towards Epiphany, the Three Kings, again, the Holy Innocents, King Herod. We say Bandar is the new Herod in the Middle East. So, the other warmonger action. Sony and North Korea. Well, you know, I hope you know, what the story is on the U.S. North Korea gambit, right? The famous DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And, they are used by the U.S. quite, I think, prominently. This is a means of keeping the Japanese and to some extent the Chinese and the Koreans in line by having these crises that are used to scare Japan, scare China, scare South Korea, scare Taiwan, scare the Philippines, scare Vietnam, scare Indonesia, scare everybody in the neighborhood. Whenever the U.S. feels that the imperialist discipline in the Far East is being eroded, time to pull the chain on the DPRK. Now, this is not just speculation. Let's go to a somewhat dubious news site, but still, gold is where you find it. The Daily Beast, British, very close to British intelligence. Exclusive, Sony emails say State Department blessed Kim Jong-un assassination in the interview. So, CEO of Sony, Michael Linton, L-Y-N-T-O-N, showed a rough cut of the movie to U.S. officials before moving ahead. Now hackers are threatening to bomb any theater. Well, we're just told Christmas this year will be dominated not by Mutalab, the underwear bomber, as in 2009, but it's going to be dominated by The Interview, because The Interview is going to be shown in selected theaters, on Christmas Day, December 25th. This is already going by the time you hear me. So, the Daily Beast says they've got emails that show two U.S. government officials pre-screened a rough cut of the assassination sequence in the interview, where you have a final scene where the dictator's head explodes. How about this? These are provocateurs. Act of war. Well, I guess in many ways it is an act of war. Now, forget about the guardians of the peace. This can be anything. This can be the CIA itself. This could be anybody you want. So here's the idea. The movie has been coordinated with the Rand Corporation. Isn't that interesting? Oop. I don't know. I don't want Rand. My God, it's giving me Rand Paul. No, I'm talking about the Rand Corporation. So the idea is that the coordination was two U.S. government officials pre-screened. The State Department was very much involved in it, as was the Rand Corporation, always according to the people here at the Daily Beast. Here we go. U.S. blessed. Let's see if I can find the Rand Corporation. This Daily Beast website, quite jittery. Please not this. Anyway, you get the idea. Let's go. We'll get it from the best way to get these things, as always, is my own Twitter feed. So the idea is simply that the U.S. government previewed the interview, and the State Department and the Rand Corporation had input into the production of the movie. So this is not freedom of the press. This is a provocation by intelligence agencies acting under the cover, the veil of Sony Pictures. Read it in the Daily Beast. William Boot is the guy who says this. Is that an act of war? Well, that's arguable. I hope won't be seen as war. But now this has been done. A series of leaked emails reveal that Sony enlisted the services of Bruce Bennett, a senior defense analyst at the Rand Corporation who specializes in North Korea. He consulted with them on the interview after he saw the film, including the gruesome ending where a giant missile hits Kim Jong-un's helicopter in slow motion as Katy Perry's Firework plays. Anybody's guess what that is? Kim's head catches on fire and explodes. Bennett gave his assessment of it in a June 25th email to Linton just 5 days before the North, 5 days after the North Korean threat. The North has never, and this is what he says, the North has never executed an artillery attack against the balloon launching area, so it's very hard to tell what is pure bluster since they use active war so commonly. I thought a bunch more about the ending. I have to admit that the only resolution I can see to the North Korean nuclear and other threats is for the North Korean regime to eventually go away. So it's part of a destabilization strategy, if you will. And the target, however, primarily China, because we've got all kinds of people, Gordon Chang of Forbes saying, that internet connection goes to China, back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So delving into this interesting article in The Daily Beast, inspired by British intelligence, perhaps. The story of how Sony turned to the State Department, the U.S. government, and the Rand Corporation. The Rand Corporation, of course, the old United States Strategic Bombing Survey, the Bland Corporation of Dr. Strangelove, you know, the drill. It is, if not the brain or the heart of the U.S. intelligence community, it's the liver or the stomach. It's a vital organ. So this guy, Bruce Bennett, after viewing the head explosion, he says, I have briefed my book on preparing for the possibility of a North Korean collapse. I have been clear that the assassination of Kim Jong-un is the most likely path to a collapse of the North Korean government. Thus, while toning down the ending may reduce the North Korean response, I believe that a story that talks about the removal of the Kim family and the creation of the new of a new government by the North Korean people, and then he says in Paris, well, at least by the elites, yeah, right, will start some real thinking in South Korea, I believe, in the North, once the DVD leaks into the North, which it almost personally certainly will. So from a personal perspective, I would personally, a radical subjectivist, he wants you to know, I would personally prefer to leave the ending alone. And this guy Linton writes back, Bruce, I spoke to someone very senior in the State Department today. He agreed with everything you have been saying. Well, it really does then look as if this piece of trash, right, this piece of garbage, right, the Goebbels style of a movie, that this was actually coordinated with the U.S. government. It's nothing to do with free speech. There's no First Amendment here. And what could it be? Well, I have to go back to my I made a communication to the Hollywoodism conference in Tehran at the beginning of 2012, in which I pointed this out, that the Santa Monica headquarters of the Rand Corporation are so close to Hollywood that it's just about impossible to imagine that there's not some kind of a symbiosis. And now we have, if we needed it, we now have proof positive that this is the case, right? So the Rand Corporation. Let me see if I can find you some quotes from this article of mine. I'll do that while we push on. Then the other angle, of course, is the Gordon Chang of Forbes magazine, and he's on TV saying, "Look, the internet connections of North Korea, DPRK, all go through China." So therefore, he says, those Chinese, they are complicit. They furnished the technology for this, right? This is all the Chinese, and therefore we've got to get rid of them. So, well, this is not good. And here we go. Here's what I write about in this, where did American movies come from? And I show this question of about 1,000 writers over a period of 2 to 3 years, perhaps 500 is an upper estimate, write these movies. How do some of these 500 or so top writers manage to incorporate terror scenarios into movies? Nobody knows for sure, but one institution of interest might be the Rand Corporation of Santa Monica, California, by the Pacific Ocean on the western edge of Los Angeles, and thus very close to Hollywood. It's the Strategic Bombing Survey. It became famous thanks to Herman Kahn with the world targets in Megadeth's Bland Corporation. Writing a recent account of Rand, or reviewing a recent account of Rand by Alex Abella, the Washington Post wrote, "Those who remember the Cold War will doubtless be familiar with the Rand Corporation, the think tank in sunny Santa Monica that Soviet propagandists branded as the Academy of Science and Death." And, then there is the case of Amy Pascal, currently co-chair of Sony Pictures Entertainment, a company which controls a substantial slice of Hollywood, including Columbia Pictures, Screen Gems, Sony Pictures Animation, TriStar Pictures. Amy Pascal has been the prime mover behind the cult movie The Da Vinci Code, which represents an attack on religion, specifically Christianity, from the point of view of atheism, paganism, or something worse. She restarted the Bond movies in 2005. Well, Amy Pascal, one of the top people in Washington, in Hollywood, has been on the board of the Rand Corporation. So how about that? Let's just check again exactly when. Let's just check the Amy Pascal. Amy Pascal, one of the bosses of Sony, has served on the board of trustees of the Rand Corporation in recent years. Oh my God. And this was written in, January of 2011, sorry, 2012. January 2012, Hollywood's War Propaganda by yours truly, Dr. Webster G. Tarpley, PhD. So let's not hear about free speech. Let's forget it. This is an inside job. This stinks to high heaven. Now, let's push ahead. Naturally, in the case of Cuba, we're all for normalization. We are against embargoes and economic warfare and sanctions in principle. There may be some rationale for regulating the trade of certain weapons systems. That's a different story. But anything normal, food, clothing, shelter, fuel, energy, equipment, machinery, all of that should flow freely. We need world economic development. But notice, of course, the reactionaries are coming out in droves for this thing. I would simply suggest, if you want to see how you bring down a dictatorship in a reasonable way, go back to the DDR, right, East Germany. And East Germany, of course, was a very oppressive dictatorship, and thousands of people proved how oppressive they found this by leaving, and leaving in a sort of routine way until 1961 with the Berlin Wall. But then after that, risking their lives to get shot by automatic shooting devices, automatic machine guns, shotguns, in the German border and the Berlin to the West Berlin to DDR border and the West Berlin to East Berlin border. So this was oppressive. And how did that come down? Well, it started in Leipzig, didn't it? And it started in Leipzig because Leipzig was the home of the Leipzig Trade Fair, the Leipziger Messe. So the Leipzig Trade Fair brought in all kinds of foreign influences. And then when the vigils, the candlelight vigils started in the late 80s, well, that's where it started. So if you want to contribute to a gradual and reasonable liberalization, let's say, of the Castro regime, you probably want to do that by increased trade, not by collapse. Obama is quite sound. You don't want to collapse because out of that can come God knows what. But now let's recall ourselves. The Pope was absolutely key in setting up this opening. And what I would say is one of the most hopeful signs here at the end of the year is that Pope Francis is on the go. One of the things he did is, I'm sure he can see, with all of his Vatican intelligence and nuncios and Vatican diplomatico, he can see that people like Allen and Kerry and Rice and Samantha Power, and I'm afraid Robert Malley now too, they're all pushing Obama over the precipice of war. And they've done it quite successfully in the Ukrainian area, right? He's gone out way too far, less so with Syria. But the Pope is pulling Obama away from the edge of the abyss. And we need to support that. So here's what I would point to. Remember that the Pope has fired one of the most reactionary of all the cardinals, Cardinal Raymond Burke from Wisconsin, the John Birch Society cardinal, I would call him. That guy has been fired, but he's still blabbing. He's still talking to Le Figaro. My guess is that Burke is trying to activate the Monsignor Lefebvre group, who was, gave such a hard time to Paul VI in the 60s and 70s. And then, what I want to focus on in the next segment, the philippic by Pope Francis against the bureaucrats of the Vatican Curia Romana, the cardinals there in Rome. We'll get to that in just a second. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Gosh, it's the end of our Between the Years broadcast already. We'll be back with more guests and interviews next week. And remember, please just mark, save the date at this point, 23rd, 24th, 25th of January here in Washington, D.C. And please don't forget to send those greetings to Reverend Pinckney. He is currently held incommunicado, more or less, in Jackson, Michigan. But now, the Pope. Okay, so the Pope pulling Obama away from the precipice of war, the way I see it, countering these lunatic warmongers, the humanitarian bombers in the administration and the neocons in and around the administration. Firing this Cardinal Raymond Burke, that's the way to go. Get rid of some of these people. The American Catholic bishops are, in general, one of the worst parts of the Catholic Church. Almost anything is better. American priests are better. American, foreign prelates can also be quite decent, but not these American bishops. And Cardinal Burke, I take it, although now a cardinal or was a cardinal, this is not good. And here's the idea. 22nd of December, in the Clementine Hall in the Vatican, Pope Francis came out and exchanged Christmas greetings with the members of the various congregations. Now, the congregations are the executive departments, right? The ministries. So it's a whole bunch of cardinals, archbishops, bishops, monsignori, and so forth. And here's the Philippic. The Curia means this court, right? The Roman court, meaning now all of these church officials, is always required to better itself and to grow in communion, sanctity, and wisdom. But here are the problems. I can't give the whole list, but the sickness of considering yourself immortal, immune, or indispensable, and neglecting the controls on that. You've got to be self-critical. It's the sickness of the rich fool who thinks that he will live for all eternity, and of those who transform themselves into masters and believe themselves superior to others rather than at their service. Then, Marthaism. Marthaism, right, part of the group around, around Christ. Excessive industriousness. The sickness of those who immerse themselves in work and who inevitably neglect the better part of sitting at the feet of Jesus. Therefore, Christ required the disciples to rest, at least somewhat, since neglecting rest leads to stress and agitation. Rest, once one who has brought his or her mission to a close, is a necessary duty and must be taken seriously. Spend a little time with your relatives. Respect the holiday. In terms of Ecclesiastes, there's a time and a season for everything under heaven. Then, sickness of mental and spiritual hardening. You lose your inner serenity, vivacity, and boldness. Conceal yourself behind paper. Become a working machine rather than a follower of God. The ailment of excessive planning and functionalism. The sickness of poor coordination. And then, perhaps the most headlinable, spiritual Alzheimer's disease, forgetfulness of the history of salvation, the ailment of rivalry and vainglory when appearances such as the color of your robes, insignia, and honors become the main aim in life. And then you become false. You have false mysticism and false quietism. How about this? Existential schizophrenia, the sickness of those who live a double life because of hypocrisy, of the mediocre and progressive spiritual emptiness that cannot be filled by degrees or academic honors. Then we have gossip, the sickness of chatter, grumbling, and gossip is a serious illness that sometimes begins simply, and then you become a sower of discord, like Satan. And in many cases, cold-blooded murderers of the reputations of your colleagues. The sickness of deifying leaders. The disease of indifference towards others when you think only of yourself. The illness of the funereal face that in order to be pious, you've got to scowl, right? Got to treat everybody bad. The disease of accumulation. The ailment of closed circles when belonging to a group becomes stronger than belonging to, in this case, the church as a whole. The disease of worldly profit and exhibitionism. So he says, we are therefore required at this Christmas time and in all the time of our service and existence to speak the truth in love. So that's quite a Philippic. There were a lot of long faces among those reactionaries because, remember, there are lots of reactionaries there. But with this, of course, he is following in the footsteps of who? Of Dante, of Petrarca, Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, known as Pius II, and so on down the line. So that's the word from the Pope. Now, in just a couple of more things on Greece. A representative of Syriza on France 24 this afternoon, Katrugalos, K-A-T-R-O-U-G-A-L-O-S. There is no Grexit. Greece will not leave the euro. It simply wants to renegotiate the IMF, Troika, conditionalities, to reduce austerity, to roll back austerity, to end austerity. So don't listen to that stuff that he wants to leave the euro. That's not the idea. Write down the debt, roll back the austerity program. And they have been able to hang tough now for a couple of years. No austerity, no compromise on austerity. These are not mushheads. The mushheads in the U.S. can learn a lot from these people. Now, Grillo. We had an article some time ago in the British press. The London Guardian said, why doesn't Russell Brand become the Beppe Grillo of Britain? Oh, I'm sorry. Here's the way it goes right now. In the past several months, Grillo's movement, this party, it's a party, of course, the five-star movement has gone, they have gone down by 26 members. They have lost about, what, one-fifth of their entire strength, one-fifth to one-sixth of their entire strength. That means they've lost 26 members of parliament, have either been expelled or have left. The most recent is a group of three. Three of the Grillini quit. They're from Latina. It's a place a little bit southeast, southwest of Rome. In effect, Grillo has thrown, what, 1.3, 1.4 million votes out the window. To get 26 people into parliament takes over a million votes, to be sure. So the Grillo movement is breaking up. It's going to end. It's going to go. It's going to become a sect or a collection of sects, and they're going to be bought and sold to elect the next president of Italy, because not just Greece needs a new president. Italy is going to have a new president soon also. Now, concerning that that class we want to give here, I just wanted to point to one thing. What does it mean to be a genius? If we look at Hollywood, Hollywood has been purveying, I think, some very misguided notions of genius, and I'll tell you three of them. John Nash, a beautiful mind, Hollywood. And this poor guy was a paranoid, still is, a paranoid schizophrenic who spent decades in and out of psychiatric institutions. He is the originator of the theory of game theory. He's the game theory man, and I think this is not useful for economic analysis. We've got Alan Turing, British code breaker, and we've got Stephen Hawking. And if you look at the Hollywood version of genius, it's John Nash, Alan Turing, and Stephen Hawking. And I'm here to tell you that is not genius. And we'll we wish you at this point Happy New Year, and we'll see you soon.